Welcome to the presentation of a lecture from Gnostic Radio, a free public service from Telema Press. Gnostic Radio broadcasts free lectures from the Gnostic tradition of Samael on Vior. Each lecture explores another aspect of this timeless and sacred knowledge. Many of these lectures are supported by additional materials available on our website. Each Saturday, Gnostic Radio broadcasts live. The live lecture is accompanied by an anonymous chat session, allowing listeners to read additional explanations related to the lecture and providing an opportunity to ask questions of the speaker. All of the efforts of Telema Press, including this lecture, are made possible by the financial support of listeners like you. Help us to help humanity by making a donation. Telema Press is a non-profit corporation. Donations are tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at GnosticTeachings.org. Now, with heartfelt wishes for the end of suffering for all creatures, we begin the lecture. May all beings be happy.
The 11th sign of the zodiac corresponds to that stellar influence of Aquarius. The symbol of Aquarius, the icon, is a woman with an urn or a vessel in either hand, carefully mixing the liquid between these two vessels. The same icon, the same image, is visible in the 14th arcanum of the Tarot, which we call temperance. This symbol contains within itself the mystical science, the precise understanding of alchemy. Alchemy, of course, is a term that directly translated means the chemistry of God. And alchemy is a process whereby forms of matter are manipulated consciously. In other words, nature is worked with in a conscious way in order to arrive at a transcendental goal. But as with any science, with any chemical process, will is the determining factor. In other words, we can use a science through evil will in order to accomplish a desire, or we can use a science through conscious will in order to realize the purposes and goals of creation in accordance with the laws. If we analyze the name Aquarius, we find in it these elemental attributes which relate directly to this science of alchemy. The first part is obviously aqua, Aquarius, aqua. And aqua, of course, is water. from the Latin. And Arius, or Air, and we know, of course, that Aquarius as a sign is related to the air. Each of the zodiacal signs is related to an element. And that element provides a foundational influence in the way that that constellation or zodiacal sign can influence the psyche. Air, of course, is related to the mind, related to the eagle, to the mind which can reach lofty heights. The air, the mind, related to thought, to intellect, and of course to buddhi, the spiritual soul. Aqua, or water, is of course related to yasod. The water figures significantly in all religions. In particular, it would be a worthwhile endeavor to spend a little time analyzing the appearances of water in the Bible. And you'll discover that there is a great number of miracles and magical works in the Bible, all of which are related to water. If we looked simply at the Gospels, we would discover that a vast number of the miracles of Jesus were accomplished by means of water. And this is no accident. It is symbolic. And the water that performs the magic is the water that is being mixed between the two urns in the 14th Arcanum. It is the water of Aquarius. Jesus talks about the water of life, which springs up in the belly, which is, of course, if you've studied any kind of Chinese medicine, then you've heard of the Dan Dian, the ocean of qi, which is, of course, related with the lower abdomen. This is symbolic of sexual energy. The sexual energy, the sexual forces, are accumulated and polarized through the sexual organs, which are not merely the external component that hangs or is present or visible from the outside of the body, but is also related to the internal glands and internal chakras, which are related with the lower abdomen. So the water and the air, or in other words, the water and the spirit. In the Gospels, Jesus tells Nicodemus that we must be born again of water and spirit. These are the two elements of Aquarius. So what is this Aquarian mystery? What is the deep hidden knowledge related to the water and the air? Some of you may have heard that very recently we as a race, as a planet, entered into a new age, a new era of development. Different groups calculate the passing into this new age in different ways. But all agree that within the last few decades, we entered into a new era, the age of Aquarius. And in Gnosis, we assign that transition to February 4th, 1962. this transition was the movement out of the age of Pisces, which we'll study in the next lecture, and into the age of Aquarius, which is the age that we're in now. And as you can easily perceive, since the year 1962, humanity has undergone a tremendous change. Beginning with that period of time, the early 1960s, there was a huge shift in our psychological environment. All of our social systems began to change in radical ways. We witnessed huge upsets in the balance of power between man and woman. We witnessed a huge revolution in the way people think about life, but in particular about sex. Starting in the 1960s, this revolution spread around the world to abandon the previous concept of sexuality, which was stale, which was regressive, which was suppressive. In other words, in the Piscean era, humanity was enslaved by sex, hid sexuality, suppressed it, didn't like to talk about it, kept everything related to sex hidden. And this is because of the influence of the Piscean forces. In particular, we find this was especially true of the tantric mysteries. Tantrism, or true alchemy, was hidden from the eyes of the population. And it was only in the years leading up to the dawning of the Aquarian Age that tantric mysteries began to be revealed in an open fashion. And of course, throughout the 60s and 70s, the interest and investigation of Tantra began to increase dramatically. Until nowadays, there's a vast number of people who've heard of Tantrism and always equate it with sexuality. But unfortunately, the understanding of Tantrism in these times is corrupt. Aquarius is the bringer of knowledge. So when we entered into the Aquarian Age, we entered into a time within which humanity is due to receive knowledge, science. And in a very superficial form, we can see that reflected in the arrival of what people are calling the information age, which is this time when, in our economics and in our social systems, we've shifted away from a materialistic basis for our economic health. And the shift now is on an information basis, or knowledge, wisdom, understanding, learning. This is a very superficial reflection of the influence of the Aquarian era. The heart of the Aquarian influence is in esoteric knowledge. But to understand that, we need to know a little bit about this word knowledge and what precisely it's referring to. We tend to make the assumption that knowledge is related to the intellect. And intellectual knowledge is a form of understanding, a form of knowledge that is necessary. But it is the bottom. It's only the most superficial, most shallow level of knowledge. is intellectual knowledge. So to comprehend why we talk about Aquarius as the bringer of knowledge, we're going to look a little bit at some Sanskrit terminology, which can open up some doors for us in our understanding. In Sanskrit, there's the word vidya, V-I-D-Y-A. We also hear the word jnana, which is J-N-A-N-A. And both of these terms are translated as knowledge. Vidya actually has two meanings. Two forms of knowledge are enclosed by vidya. The first is aparavidya. A-P-A-R-A, aparavidya. And this is simple intellectual knowledge. Or in other words, lower knowledge. The other form of avidya, primary form, is called paravidya. And this is higher knowledge. But paravidya is intuitive, experiential knowledge. So in the understanding of two forms of vidya, we see immediately the two forms of Kabbalah. The Master Samael pointed out very clearly that there are two kinds of Kabbalists. Intellectual Kabbalists, who only study theories and memorize things, but have no experience of what they study. And these would be people who are gathering aparavidya, which is intellectual understanding, intellectual knowledge. But the second kind of Kabbalist follows after paravidya, which is intuitive spiritual experience. In other words, they directly experience the truths of the Tree of Life. They have penetrated consciously into the experience of the Kabbalah. We have another kind of person next to these two, or another form, which is called avidya, which is the word vidya with an A in front of it. Now you'll notice that aparavidya is just like paravidya with an A in front. And avidya is vidya with an A in front. The A means without. So avidya is without knowledge. In other words, without experience. Even without intellectual understanding. And in both Hinduism and Buddhism, they say the source of all suffering is avidya, ignorance, to ignore. Ignore is an I with G-N-O, G-N-O from gnosis, E without, just like the A in avidya. If you've studied Hinduism, you've studied the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is a discourse given by Krishna, who is the Christ in the Hindu mysteries. And Krishna, throughout the entire discourse of the Bhagavad Gita, is emphasizing knowledge. But he clearly differentiates two forms of knowledge. In the most translations, you'll find them as phenomenal and luminous. Numinous and phenomenal. And Krishna states explicitly that we need both of these forms of knowledge, both of these forms of vidya. Phenomenal, of course, is related to phenomena, manifested things, to have knowledge of our environment, to have knowledge of what we perceive. Numinous is to have knowledge of spiritual things. These are vidya and jnana. Vidya would be related to numinous knowledge, spiritual knowledge. Jnana is just knowing knowledge in general. So it's good to understand when you're studying these scriptures the different subtleties of the terms. And the reason is our own thinking, our own understanding is our obstacle. There are some who read a scripture and read in that scripture, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna tells Arjuna, spiritual liberation comes through knowing me. So most followers of Hinduism read that and think the way the Christians do. If I believe in Krishna, I'm saved. This is false. This is not what Krishna is saying. Krishna is saying, by knowing me, this is not belief. This is experiential, conscious. Many of us have a hard time conceiving of that idea, that you could actually know Krishna personally. But that is the point of real religion. To know for oneself. To converse with the prophets, with the gods. To talk to them. To get answers from them. To get guidance. This is the purpose of religious studies, really. It's not just to stuff our heads with concepts. That is the lowest form of knowledge, intellectual. And that is aparavidya, which is low knowledge. It's related to spiritual things, but it's stuck in the intellect. We need paravidya, experiential knowledge, knowledge of the wisdom of the gods through our own direct experience. And to have acquired that consciously, not by reading, but by doing it. That is why we call this science gnosis. Gnosis means knowledge. But it isn't knowledge from books. And it also is not knowledge by association. In other words, in the Christian traditions nowadays, there is this prevalent belief that if you believe, then you're saved. And the same exists in Buddhism and Hinduism and other religions. There are followers and practitioners who simply think that if they believe in that religion, if they follow their priest, then they are saved. Believe it or not, there are people in the Gnostic tradition who are the same, who take their cultural predisposition, usually a Christian background, and they project that in gnosis. So they believe that so long as they're associated to a certain group, they are saved. And this is false. This is exactly why Samael and Vior emphasized to not follow anyone except your own being. And the reason is that our ego seeks security, wants safety, wants to feel safe by being associated with someone else or some group or some school. So there are students who attach themselves to an instructor and have the belief that because this instructor is supposedly very elevated or very advanced or very awake, that the student will be saved merely by cause of association. This is not true. We are saved by our works. We are saved by our consciousness, by the one who's in us, by knowing our own inner God, not by knowing anyone outside, not by associating with any school. The one who saves is the Christ, and he is within. This is the emphasis of the Bhagavad Gita. The Gita says this throughout the book. But in particular, if we study in chapter 7, this chapter is often translated as the knowledge of the absolute. And this is where that famous quote comes from, where Krishna says, out of many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection. And of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. That knowledge, that knowing, is aparavijja, which is conscious knowledge. Now, there's another way to look at this term vidya. And it's a way that the Master Samael used when explaining the nature of gnosis. And he said that there are different kinds of knowledge that we study. Of course, we know that mysticism, religion, comes in many forms. But when we analyze them, we find that they all pretty much contain the same things, just organized a little differently with maybe some different terms. The first of these types of knowledge that Samael and Vior is indicating is called Jnana Vidya. And this is spelled Y-A-J-N-A. Jnana Vidya is defined as certain types of rituals which are performed in order to awaken powers, to awaken latent capacities within. The second one is Mahavidya. And Mahavidya is related to the metaphysics, the Kabbalah, the study of the laws and structures, Kala Chakra. Maha means great. And the third is Gupta Vidya. And Gupta Vidya is related to the use of sound, mantra, recitation, prayer. These three terms are a Sanskrit point of view designed to help put the different aspects of the knowledge that we study into an organized grouping. What's interesting to note is this. Jnana Vidya is related to certain kinds of rituals. The term yajna means sacrifice. So when we read in the Bible or we study ancient religions and we read about sacrifices that priests perform, this would be rituals or practices that fall into the grouping of Jnana Vidya. And the purpose of these practices is to gather energy. But as I mentioned previously, any of these forms of science can be used in one of two ways. By evil will, or egotistical will, or desire will. Or by conscious will. In other words, the will of Atman. Atman, in Sanskrit, is a term that's used to refer to the self. And there is this fourth type of knowledge, which is Atmavidya, or the knowledge of the being, the knowledge of the self, self-knowledge. And Samael and Vior explains that Atmavidya encloses and encompasses all the other forms of knowledge and supersedes them and may use them, but in a purified way. In other words, true self-knowledge cannot be used in two different ways. The ego cannot enter into atmavidya. Desire cannot enter. Atmavidya is the wisdom of the being, wisdom of our innermost, direct knowledge, experiential knowledge, intuitive knowledge of the truth, which is free of desire. This form of knowledge, this kind of wisdom, can utilize rituals, Kabbalah, astrology, cartomancy, mantra, prayer, invocation, conjuration, any number of spiritual sciences, but only in a pure way, without desire, without ego. This is atmavidya. So as we explained before, mahavidya, which is Kabbalistic studies, could be either utilized by the ego through desire to build pride, to answer fear, to find a sense of security. And there are many who enter into spiritual studies, religious studies, because they're very afraid, and they find confidence in studying religion. They find a sense of security in becoming attached to a religious group or a teacher. But this, unfortunately, is a use of vidya, or knowledge, by the ego. And that, in turn, makes it avidya, ignorance. In synthesis, we would say, this is how the air of the mind and the water of the sex combine in our psyche to produce suffering. Because the ego corrupts that knowledge. And what we need is temperance. The woman in the card, the 14th arcanum, is our Divine Mother. And as you know, the Divine Mother is a symbol of knowledge. She has that veil of Isis, which symbolizes that veil, which stands before the temple, which prohibits the animal from entering into the sacred precinct. And that animal is your own mind. The animal mind has to be sacrificed. This is real yajna vidya. This is ahamkara. This is the sacrifice of the I. This is how you arrive at atmavidya, which is the knowledge of the being. Because to enter atmavidya, or that superlative knowledge, the ego cannot be present. So that ego has to be sacrificed. Now, I mentioned that yajna is the name means sacrifice. But that term is also used as a descriptive for a god. Do you know which one? Vishnu. This is where things get really interesting. In Gnosis, we study this tree of life. And at the top of the tree of life, we have three spheres. This is called the supramonad, or the supernal triangle. These three are one. They symbolize the tri-unity, or the Trinity, which is the basis of every religion. In Christianity, we call them Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. In Kabbalah, they are called Keter, Chokmah, and Binah. So the second one in Hebrew is called Chokmah. In Gnosticism, this is the second logos. In Hinduism, these are Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. So the second one is Vishnu. Yajna is a name for Vishnu. And in Hinduism, they have the mythology of Vishnu. And this mythology presents in stories how Vishnu, as this very elevated god, due to his compassion, will manifest himself into the world in order to teach Vidya, to teach his knowledge. Krishna is one of his incarnations. Rama is one of his incarnations. Jesus, Buddha, these are all incarnations of Vishnu. Avatars, in other words. But his name, Vishnu, begins with V-I. The same as Vidya. The same as wisdom, visdom. Chokmah, the second sphere, is the Hebrew word for wisdom. This is no accident. It's not coincidental that Vishnu and Chokmah, Sanskrit and Hebrew, mean the same thing. It's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence that all of the bodhisattvas, bodhisattva means essence of wisdom, incarnation of Christ. All the bodhisattvas incarnate Vishnu. Within them is born the Christ child, who is Krishna, who is Rama, who is Buddha. And the name of that birth, the name of that force, the essence of that intelligence is sacrifice, yajna. For that birth to occur, there has to be a death. So here you see, I'm describing for you three essential factors. Birth, death, and sacrifice. These are the three essential components of any religion, of any form of spirituality. You can call yourself whatever you want. You can attach yourself to any religion. You can follow any master, any scripture. But to awaken the consciousness, you must practice these three factors. Without them, you cannot awaken. It's impossible. These three form the basis upon which every religion that has ever existed are formed. And these three are symbolized in the stories of the great prophets and masters, the great saints, the avatars, the gods. In the life of Jesus, we have his mystical birth. We have his lifetime of sacrifice. And we have his mystical death. We see the same in the life of John the Baptist. We see the same in the life of Krishna, in the life of Buddha, in the life of Moses, in the life of Heracles. Heracles in particular is very interesting. Heracles symbolizes the Christ in the Greek mysteries. He performed many tremendous works, great labors, impossible for a mere mortal. And he was able to accomplish these great labors because he was part divine. In other words, he was a bodhisattva. He had incarnated part of a god within. But he still had his human, impure aspect. At the end of his mythology, you find that he dies a very painful death. But that death symbolizes the absolute death of everything in him that was impure. All the human parts die. And what rises is the divine, purified, complete. When he ascends to Olympus as a purified being, the gods give him a present, a wife. And this wife, this woman, is named Hebe, H-E-B-E. Have you ever seen a picture of her? You'll be astonished. She is a young goddess, daughter of Zeus and Hera, who carries in her two hands two vessels. She's the cupbearer of the gods and is seen mixing the waters. And she serves in these vessels ambrosia, the food and drink of the gods, that fuel, that energy which makes them immortal. She becomes the wife of Heracles. She's the symbol of Aquarius. This same image of the woman with the two cups is Hebe, the wife of Heracles, the great warrior. What this indicates to us is that by following in the footsteps of the great masters, learning how to accomplish the factors of birth and death and sacrifice, we arrive at the union of our pure element, our pure psyche, the pure consciousness, the union of that with Hebe in us, who is that divine feminine force who provides immortality, perfection. But that is arrived at through great works, not by reading books. Heracles didn't sit around and read books. Neither did Krishna. Neither did Jesus. Reading books can be useful, but does not bring awakening. You cannot awaken the consciousness with the intellect. You cannot awaken the consciousness with a belief. You can't awaken it with a ritual. You can't awaken it with a mantra, with Kabbalah. You awaken it by using it. And all of these things help, but they don't do it on their own. You can utilize all the mantras you want as part of Gupta Vidya, which many practitioners of Hinduism and Buddhism do. In Buddhism, you'll often hear that the beginners are given practices to perform 100,000 recitations of a given mantra. And so they set to it. There may be some benefit from that in different ways, but it does not awaken consciousness. You'll find that Buddhists and Hindus alike place a great value on hundreds of thousands of recitations of mantras, or doing prostrations, or doing circumambulations, walking around sacred sites. Like the Christians, who value doing hundreds of recitations of Hail Mary, or the Lord's Prayer. Or the Gnostics, who value reciting certain mantras, or doing certain invocations or conjurations, doing certain kinds of practices. These are all useful, but they in themselves do not awaken consciousness. They assist. They provide help, but they don't do it. The one who does it is you. If you don't consciously utilize the tools, then you remain asleep. And this is why in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Now hear how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free of doubt." In full consciousness. Not in belief. Conscious. To be conscious of something is to perceive it. When you're unconscious, you are not perceiving. It's very simple, but often overlooked. How many practitioners of religion do all of these great efforts with rituals, with mantras, with study, with pranayamas, with meditation, practicing meditation for hours and hours, but without consciousness of it? This is a tragedy. All of these practices, all of these scriptures, are given only to assist the individual effort to awaken consciousness. And to awaken consciousness is something you do right now. Not later. It's not something you think, I'm going to meditate later to awaken, or I'll do these mantras later. That's good. You should do those practices. They will help you. But they on their own cannot awaken you. Awakening is in each moment, to be awake, to perceive consciously, to be aware. This is where Atma Vidya is born. In the moment. The consciousness that we have is that which connects us with divine intelligence, with divine forces, with our own Atman, our own Buddha. That self is not a self in the sense of a guy on a throne somewhere. It is consciousness. Simple. If you study the Bhagavad Gita, you see that Krishna states that explicitly. Atma is consciousness. Not someone on a throne, not a superior I, not a me that's better than me. Consciousness, all-pervading, all-present, all-perceiving. And this is what the Buddha was indicating when he said there is no independently existing self. To point out for the Hindus, for the Brahmins, the idea of self you have is false. That you have some superior I in another plane of consciousness who is your real self. We have a real self. We have Atman. We have a spirit. But that sense of self is consciousness, which is selfless. Our real being has no I. It sounds contradictory. When in Gnosis we say that we, as intellectual animals, as the people that we are, don't have real individuality. And we see that because of our direct experience. That from moment to moment, we contradict ourselves. There's no one I. There are many I's. Today, I'm very good friends with a given person. Tomorrow, I'm their enemy. Because one I was here today and another I is here tomorrow. These are samskaras. These are aggregates. These I's are individual egos which have no organization, no continuity. Chaos within our psyche. These are the 100 brothers that the Pandava have to kill in the Mahabharata. Those legions of eyes. We, in one moment, feel happy, and the next we feel angry. In one moment we feel good, and the next we feel depressed. There are individual elements, aspects, psychological components, which rise and pass, that utilize us to express themselves, to get energy. We call these eyes. And they work in us through our psychological centers. Sometimes they work through the intellect, through our thoughts. Sometimes they work through our emotional center, through feelings. Sometimes through the motor center, through our mechanical habits. Sometimes through our instinct, through fight or flight, through different kinds of desire. And sometimes they work through sex. These five centers are different aspects of our psyche that process energy. And the eyes arise and pass, coming into the driver's seat of our psyche to run the show for a period of time until another one comes and knocks it out of the way. All the while, we think we are one. But who is this I? Who is myself? If the basis of realization is self-knowledge, we have to investigate this. How is the knowledge of our true self arrived at if we ignore the self that we are now? Absolute self-knowledge is knowledge of oneself in every level. The Master Samael says that the one who achieves this becomes the perfect nine, which is related to the ninth arcanum of the Tarot, but refers directly to having perfect knowledge of oneself in all the 18 spheres of the Tree of Life. Nine related to the heavens, nine related to the hells. In this moment, we begin by being conscious. By being conscious of what we do, by being conscious of what we think, of what we feel. And in this way, we analyze our psyche, always watchful. You notice how in the Bible and in the Hinduism, they say the self is the watcher. That's because real self is consciousness, who is always watching. But when we're asleep, when we're being mechanical, we forget that real self. So the watcher is not active. This is why we enter into suffering. Remaining conscious, watching our five centers, we start to gather knowledge of who we really are. We observe when we feel irritated. We watch that irritation to find out what thoughts are associated with that. What feelings are associated with that irritation? What sensations? Where is that irritation coming from? What does it want? This is not something that's done in a day or a week. This is a lifetime. To know oneself in every detail. By knowing oneself in detail, we learn to discriminate. And this is where we start to exercise will. Normally, the way we are now, desires come and go throughout our five centers. We have a desire to learn about these kinds of things, to study mysticism, to study religion. But do we know where that desire comes from? Do we know what's attached to that? What that desire expects? We have to investigate that, to know what is our motivation. Not to theorize about it, not to have ideas about it, to perceive it. To find experientially what's driving the different elements that arise in our psyche. This kind of analysis is not in the intellect. There are some groups who try to analyze the psyche by developing diagrams, by developing a sophisticated outline of the psychological structure that we have. So they'll map out pride and anger and lust and fear and come up with a very beautiful image, a very beautiful idea about that. What we have to grasp, however, is that the I is inconstant. Inconsistent. The I, each I, will work in accordance with circumstances. And circumstances always change. In other words, if you've developed an intellectual concept of the structure of your ego, that can cause you to be blind to what the ego is actually doing. Because you will see it through your filter. In the same way that when you go home today and you go to your bathroom, you don't really see your bathroom. Because you've seen it so many times that you now have a picture of it in your mind and you don't see the actual place anymore. You don't really see it. You see a mental projection. And if you don't believe that, then why do you lose your keys? Why do you lose things and then find them in a very obvious place, right in front of you. Or you don't see something that you're looking for, which is right there. And it's because your own mind is projecting an illusion that it has made. We do this constantly. This is Maya illusion. It's self-projected. Therefore, it is of little value to develop for oneself an intellectual structure of your own ego. It is of ultimate value to constantly observe the ego. Because the ego changes according to circumstances. The way your pride will come out today is rooted in the circumstances that you're in. And tomorrow, you'll be in different circumstances, and that pride will do something different. If you're looking for it to do the same thing, you'll miss it. You won't see it. And you'll remain asleep. But the knowledge of the self, the knowledge of what is arising in our own psyche, is essential. We need to know who we are and what we're doing. Because in each moment, all the energy that's transforming through you is producing consequences. You are now what you did. Everything that you are is because of what you have done. Everything. But going further, everything you are is because of how you have used energy. Simple. If you suffer, it's because you set in motion energy, which returns to you to balance itself. If you are in pain, you're in pain because of what you yourself have done, even if you don't see it right now. It's a law of nature. It's called karma. In the Bible it says, every man will reap what he sows. In other words, for every action there is a consequence. This is called invariance in physics. Any given level of energy has to return to that level. Invariably, it's a law of nature. If you invest energy into a given thing, that energy must be equilibrated. It's a law. So when you're investing energy into an anger in your heart, into lust, in your sex, into a concept in your mind, that energy must return. And if that investment of energy is contrary to the laws of nature, then there's pain. This is the basis of suffering. By knowing ourselves, by acquiring vidya, of our own self, we can change how we use energy because we can apply conscious will. A will that knows better. A will that can distinguish and discriminate between right and wrong. That is the entrance into Atma Vidya. Atma being the real self. By knowing how to behave in the right way in each moment, we start to know our own real self. Because that real self knows. It is conscious knowledge. It is conscious knowing of right and wrong. The arrival, in the ultimate sense, to that self-knowledge comes through the application of these three factors. In very simple terms,
We put it this way. We need birth. That birth comes in levels. We need first the birth of the soul. We need to create the soul. We also need death. We need the death of the ego. And we need sacrifice. We need to work on behalf of others, to help others. So in general terms, this is how we describe these three. But to get more specific, we need to see how demanding they each are. Birth, of course, is referring to that spiritual birth that Jesus was teaching to Nicodemus. We have to be born again. And he states, that which is born of flesh is flesh. But that's not the kind of birth we need. That's the first birth, which we already have. We already have that which is born of flesh, which is a physical body, symbolized in the tree of life by Malkut, the lowest sphere. But that which is born of the spirit, Atman, is spirit. We need a superior birth, spiritual birth. And this birth is derived in the same way, in a similar way, that is, as our physical one. I said before that everything that we are is because of what we've done. Everything that we are now is karmic. But that action that has produced what we are is always sexual in its base. Because all energy is, in its base, a mere modification of sexual energy. All energies are derived from the same source. So what we are physically is obviously the result of sex. Our parents had the sexual act and produced the bodies that we have. But to have a spiritual birth requires the same sexual cooperation. The cooperation between a man and a woman, who are the only ones that can create life. However, this form of life is in accordance with the laws of the Holy Spirit. To create a spiritual birth, one has to work with the science of alchemy, which is, again, symbolized in the icon of Aquarius, of the woman mixing the two vessels. These two vessels symbolize man and woman, solar and lunar, the sun and the moon, husband and wife. She does not spill a drop, but she mixes these forces in order to produce ambrosia, to create immortality. And that immortality is the creation of the soul. This is birth as one primary factor. The birth is realized when those sexual forces are gathered and purified. When male and female are made into one, says Jesus, then you will enter into the kingdom. This is in the Gospel of Thomas. When male and female are made into one, then you will enter into the kingdom. In Hebrew, kingdom is Malkut, this first sphere on the tree of life. And this is where we begin to work, to have spiritual birth. We work physically here. The first birth is when the male and female, working in scientific chastity, renounce the orgasm, gather their sexual forces, and by means of the science of tantra, or alchemy, under the guidance of the being, or Atman, those forces are harmonized and equilibrated. And when they are equilibrated, a spark is produced in the spinal column, the very base of the spinal column. This spark can produce an awakening of fire. That fire in Hinduism is called Kundalini. In Christianity, it's called the Holy Spirit. The awakening of that fire is dependent upon moral purity, qualities of the heart. The fire of the Holy Spirit is the intelligence of God. It's not mechanical. It doesn't come to anyone. It comes to those who earn it. And God rewards those who follow His laws and who are working to achieve purity of heart and mind. In other words, the Kundalini awakens only with moral progress, with death, psychologically. As the ego is killed through our psychological analysis, as we take energy away from the ego by making better choices from moment to moment, that ego starts to die. You see, in that self-observation, in meditation, in transmutation, these three factors: birth, death, and sacrifice. When we have anger stimulating us, it's very painful and very difficult to renounce, very difficult to sacrifice our anger, because our anger wants justice. Our anger wants to be fed. It's an easy matter to give up a desire, to have a pleasure. We can easily give up something that we want just for pleasure. Let's say it's sugar. We can easily renounce sugar or coffee, something like that. But it's very difficult to renounce anger. It's very difficult to renounce resentment or lust, because these form suffering, and we love our suffering. It sounds contradictory, but watch this in yourself. Next time somebody really makes you mad, try to not act on that anger in any way. Not just physically, but also in your mind. Because what you think and what you feel is an action which produces consequences. And that's why Jesus said, if you see a woman and lust for her in your heart, you've committed adultery, which is a crime. So it's not just physical action we're talking about. It's emotional. It's mental. So try to renounce your anger and see how difficult that is. But when you do it, that is an act of sacrifice. A beautiful act of sacrifice. When you renounce and do not feed your own ego, your own desire. And in that sacrifice, there is a little death. There is a step towards death, because that ego is not getting its food. But as you know, if you stop feeding the animal gets very angry. And it will fight you. It will demand to be fed. This is why the very beginning stages of learning to save the sexual energy are so hard for the beginner. Because the animal ego of lust is very hungry and very fat and used to getting all the food it wants. So when you stop feeding it, when you stop feeding your lust, when you start trying to transmute the energy, it feels like a battle of life and death. It's very difficult. But you have to remain strong and take it moment by moment, fighting against that desire. The process of death begins there. That ego starts to become weak. Eventually, transmutation is easy, physically anyway. It becomes natural, because it is the natural function of the body. But in that moment, birth is also happening. When you stop empowering the ego, you're taking those energies that are in you and beginning to put them into your consciousness. That begins birth. So you see the three factors just in self-observing: birth, death, and sacrifice. But those three factors applied from moment to moment are what empower and open the doors for the awakening of the Kundalini. And that awakening in itself is another octave of birth and death and sacrifice. In this case, each vertebra of the spinal column that we want to bring the fire up requires ordeals, tests, challenges for our own psyche. And each one of those requires the three factors. In every ordeal, in every test, in every challenge that we are given, we have to remember the three factors and look to accomplish them. The ordeals come from difficulties in life, difficulties in our relationships, difficulties at work, at school, with our family, and all the aspects of life. We have to be prepared in every moment, recalling and using the three factors. Looking at yourself and saying, what am I giving energy to? And my thinking and my feeling and in my actions. And by doing that kind of retrospection of oneself, one analysis of oneself, you can more easily perceive the ordeals and more easily overcome them. We fail when we become identified with a desire. When someone is opposed to us, maybe making fun of us, talking badly about us, when we become identified with our image, with looking bad, with being embarrassed, with being angry, we're failing that ordeal because those egos are being fed. When we, on the other hand, are understanding that pride is an ego, shame is an ego, resentment is an ego, and the being we have is perfect, we recall and remember our own God. Why do we need the approval of others? Why do we need to care if someone praises us or blames us? We can be the same. Whether we're attacked or loved, we can be the same one. And with that kind of psychological equilibrium, we gain progress in the advancement of the Kundalini. So the Kundalini has to be awakened first in the physical body. This produces a psychological change. This produces benefits for the consciousness. It provides extra help, forces which can assist us. But we have to advance. We then work on the second serpent of Kundalini related to the ethereal body, the vital body. If you've studied Buddhism, you've seen how the Buddha is often represented with seven serpents over his head. These seven serpents symbolize these first seven initiations of major mysteries, which are related to these first seven spheres on the Tree of Life. These are the initiations of fire. They're related to raising the serpents of the Kundalini in each of our bodies, the physical body, the ethereal body, the astral body, the mental body, the causal body, the Buddhic body, and the Atmic body. Each body is a body of flesh. Each one is matter. Each one is real. But only one of them is physical, which is this one, the physical body. As we are now, that's the only body that we have that we can work with consciously. We need to become conscious here and now. Become awake as a consciousness. By creating the bodies of the soul, we start to awaken consciousness in different ways, different levels. But there's no guarantee. There's nothing easy here. What I mean by that is, you can work in the process of the birth of the soul. You can be self-observing and self-remembering and be working on your ego in the physical world. You can reach the third degree, the third initiation of major mysteries, and create the astral body. That does not mean that you're awake in the astral plane. That's all. It means you have created the body, but that does not mean you're awake there. That body gives the capacity to travel awakened, but it doesn't give you the gift to be awakened there. This is a distinction that has to be grasped. It's easy to assume when studying this science that as soon as you've created the astral body, you will be 100% awake in the astral plane. It is not true. You become 100% awake in the astral plane when you awaken your consciousness there. You can do that without the astral body. Right now, we have the Kama Rupa. We have the body of desires, which is a lunar body that we use in the astral plane. When we're dreaming, we're using that body. When we lie down to sleep physically and we start to dream, we're traveling in our own body of desires. But this is a lunar mechanical body, which is basically constituted of the ego. We can have out-of-body experiences, lucid dreaming, conscious awakened experiences in the astral plane with that lunar body. Awakening the consciousness is not equivalent to creating the soul. Creating the soul is creating the soul. It's creating vessels, vehicles. But to utilize them, you have to be awake. Do you see the distinction? You can awaken without creating the bodies, like Yogananda. Yogananda awakened a great deal of consciousness and could be awakened in the astral plane, but he did not have the soul or astral body. But he had the discipline to remain conscious of himself, physically and internally. These initiations of major mysteries are processes by which the sexual forces are utilized, the initiate is tested, and the soul is created. The soul is a vessel, a vehicle. And that vehicle is utilized in order for us to gather deeper self-knowledge. But that self-knowledge comes through awakening consciousness. So don't assume that creating the bodies is going to save you. It doesn't. It gives you extra tools. In the same way that learning mantras doesn't save you, it just gives you extra tools. But obviously, having the soul or the solar bodies is a billion times more powerful than having mantras. Because those solar bodies, when you awaken and you learn how to use them, allow you to travel in other planes of consciousness. So you can penetrate more deeply into your own mind, more deeply into your own karma, more deeply into your own self, in order to free yourself of suffering. Death. Birth, obviously, is how we take the sexual forces and under the guidance and assistance of our own Divine Mother, we utilize those forces to create superior bodies and create the soul, the Merkaba. But that same energy, sexual energy, is also used to destroy the ego. This is why in Hinduism, Shiva, the Holy Spirit, is known as the creator and the destroyer. It's his fire, his energy, that creates and destroys. So, while we gather our sexual forces and transmute them, the Divine Mother takes those forces and uses them as needed. But she can only use them in accordance with our works. In order for any psychological aggregate to be destroyed, it has to be understood. Why? Each ego, each psychological element, is part of us, something that we create, that we produce. When we look at another person with lust, we take that imagery and we invest into that imagery a very potent energy, so that that image becomes more concrete. That lustful image invested with energy, that image it forms a sort of false life. Historically, these are called incubi, succubi. And these are psychological elements that we create with our lust and with our fantasy. In the same way, we create egos. Egos are psychological elements in our own mind, which are packets of trapped energy, sexual energy. When we are criticized and we feel our pride is hurt, and we think about that, and we go around with that hurt feeling, what's happening there is a transformation of energy, but in hell, our own psychological hell. That packet of energy is becoming trapped in what we call an I or an ego. It's a block in the flow of nature. It is a wrong transformation of forces. It is karma. In order for our Divine Mother to free us from that suffering, we have to extract the purity from it, the consciousness. In each ego is trapped a portion of our consciousness. When we as an animal soul first entered into humanoid bodies, we had an element of free consciousness called buddhata, tathagatagarbha, or essence. And this element is an extension of our own inner being. The essence is that which gives us the capacity to be conscious, to be aware, to pay attention, to perceive. In ancient times, all of us could perceive more than we do now. This is why in our folklore, we hear stories of sylphs, gnomes, dwarves, pygmies, elves, all kinds of creatures that nowadays we think are fantasy. And that's because in past times we could see them, because they're real, they exist. Those are the spirits of plants and rocks, the spirits of animals, which at one time we could perceive and work with directly. But over the centuries, because we've become more and more trapped in desire, in pride, in lust, in anger, in envy, in fear, we have lost more and more of our senses. We have lost the ability to perceive. We're becoming deeper and deeper buried in lust, in pride, in fear. And that's why we see the suffering of humanity getting worse. We see that instead of feeding the hungry, instead of caring for those who suffer, we're developing more and more powerful ways to destroy each other. It's because the essence is becoming increasingly trapped in the ego. When we take and harness the sexual forces, transmute them, our own Divine Mother can use that energy to destroy those packets and free the energy that's trapped in them, to free the consciousness. But she cannot do it while the energy is in there, because that would hurt us. We extract that consciousness by becoming conscious of that karma, by knowing fully that ego, by knowing fully that element in our own mind. And when we fully comprehend that particular karma, that particular I, that desire, we extract the free consciousness. We free it. At that precise moment, the Divine Mother can kill that demon, that element, which is symbolized by Durga in Hinduism, fighting the demon. So death arrives based on self-knowledge. But to just practice birth and death is insufficient. There are some who work with the forces of alchemy to transmute their sexual energy, and who meditate on the ego, but they remain stagnant. This is because they're not utilizing the third factor, which is sacrifice. To sacrifice is to follow after Vishnu, Chokhmah, the Christ. You know, in the Gospels, that Jesus said, anyone who would come after me must deny himself. This is death. Must take up his cross. And the cross is the alchemical connection of man and woman. And must follow me. Sacrifice. To emulate the Master Jesus. To do as he did, which is to give up all self-interest and to give for the benefit of others. And that's the nature of a bodhisattva. An incarnation of Yajna, Christ, sacrifice. Vishnu, Chokhmah, the Christ, has one law, sacrifice, love. The force of the Christ is the force that gives life to every existing thing. Without Christic energy, existence is not possible. All the great masters, all the great prophets, are incarnations of that Christic sacrificial force, who give freely of themselves to benefit others. They don't charge for their wisdom. They don't demand anything for themselves, like worship or even respect. They give, and they give, and they give. Even when being betrayed. Even Jesus, on the cross, betrayed, tortured, humiliated, and being stolen from, said, Father, forgive them. He demanded nothing for himself. This factor of sacrifice stands equal to birth and death and is equally necessary from moment to moment. We begin to embody that from moment to moment when we're confronted with our challenges, when we're confronted with problems. Really, problems in life are a great form of help. It's our problems that bring up the things that we need to change in us. It's in adversity that the hero comes to light. And adversity is all around us. So the Gnostic learns to take advantage of all adversity, to give thanks to be grateful, to kiss the hand of the executioner. The one who brings you suffering, the one who brings you pain, is bringing you a great gift, the opportunity to know yourself. Most of the time we waste it, and we become furious against the executioner, against the one who brings us criticism or problems. But if we can learn to take advantage of those moments, we can learn to change. Really, these three factors are elements of change. And that's why Aquarius is the most revolutionary sign of all the zodiacal signs. It provides the most capacity for change. When the age of Aquarius arrives, our whole society changes. Everything shifts. And the same is true of what Aquarius can provide in our own psyche. If we take advantage of it. We're in the Aquarian age. So that influence is very strong. Unfortunately, most people receive that influence and only use it to feed the ego. This is why when the age of Aquarius arrived, we saw such a proliferation of degenerated sexuality. Beginning in the 60s is when it became very strong and is growing. As the Aquarian age deepens and becomes stronger, as the Piscean age is moving away, we see sexual degeneration becoming more and more prevalent. And all you have to do is watch the news to see it. All you have to do is look at your friends and look to see how commonplace now degenerate sexual practices are becoming, which 30, 40 years ago would have been unheard of. And that's the influence of Aquarius, which is providing the potential to revolutionize our sexuality. Why is that? Aquarius is governed by two planets, Saturn and Uranus. Saturn, of course, as you know, is the planet related with death. Uranus is the planet related with sex. Uranus governs sexuality. That name comes from the Greek and refers to the sky. But the orbit of Uranus is an orbit of 84 years around the sun. And within that orbit, we have it divided into two parts of 42 years. As a strongly polarized planet, Uranus provides a strongly polarized influence on our psyche, but directly related with sexuality. In other words, for a given 42-year period, Uranus is giving more strength to women. And then that flips, and Uranus gives more strength or more predominance to men. The switch began, there was a movement or a shift of that influence in the 60s. And this is how we saw the women's revolution. Women's movement, where women became much more empowered, became the central focus of many of our social changes. But that shift is switching back. It's been 42 years. So now you will see over the next few years that men will receive once again more of an influence, more of a push for dominance socially. This doesn't mean that one is better than the other. It's simply a stellar influence. The point, however, is that Saturn, the planet of death, and Uranus, the planet of sex, are the ones that govern Aquarius. In other words, when we misuse the sexual forces, when we misuse the energies that are flowing through Aquarius to humanity now, what kind of death are we producing? When the sexual energy under Aquarius is misused and is combined with Saturn, what is dying? What are we killing? What form of death is being produced? For the Gnostic, for the spiritual warrior, this provides a tremendous energy to destroy the ego, to kill desire, and to come to know the truths of life and death, to come to know the gods directly. But for the one who receives those forces mechanically through the ego, it produces a tremendous energy to kill the soul, to kill the consciousness. Thus you see how our society and our culture is pushing for degenerated sexuality, is grasping after it desperately, is trying to degenerate, is trying to spread the doctrine of infrasexuality, impure sexuality, fornication and adultery, abuse, and all kinds of variations on ways of misusing the forces of the Holy Spirit. And we see then widespread suffering, growing suffering. I think you can see from the context of this course so far that in all of the zodiacal signs and the planetary influences, there are tremendous energies available to us in each moment that we use, but we use them unconsciously. And the purpose of our studies is to become conscious, to make the unconscious conscious, to bring light into our own darkness. And as such, we are in the position of receiving a lot of help. Partly because, having entered the age of Aquarius, the doors to esoteric knowledge have been thrown open. Because humanity is sharply degenerating, on a very sharp curve downwards, all of the great compassionate Buddhas said, open the doors. Humanity is doomed. Humanity cannot return from the edge of the abyss. So open the doors for the esoteric knowledge for those who want it. And give them the esoteric knowledge freely for any who want it. And for those who don't, fine. We respect that. And we'll see them all when they come out of the second death after a few thousand years in the abyss. And for those who do want it, we will help them. We'll help them by giving them ordeals and giving them more knowledge in order to overcome those ordeals. So the knowledge is being presented freely, openly, for the first time in the history of this planet, the history of this race. So we have this great opportunity to take advantage of the three factors of birth, death, and sacrifice in ourselves and awaken. Those three factors, harmonized and balanced in each moment, produce the awakening of the consciousness. This is why I stated in the beginning, you can do all the rituals you want, you can learn all the Kabbalah you want, you can learn all the mantras you want related to those other forms of vidya. And that's fine, they help. But they don't awaken consciousness. The three factors do. But those three factors have to be practiced consciously by will in each moment. There is a little part from the Bhagavad Gita that I'll read to you, which relates to this. in chapter 7 of the Bhagavad Gita. Know, and this is Krishna speaking, this is the incarnation of Christ. Know that I am the original seed, sexual seed, of all existences, the intelligence of the intelligent, and the prowess of all powerful men. I am the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. I am sex life, which is not contrary to religion. Know that all states of being, be they of goodness, passion, or ignorance, are manifested by my energy. I am, in one sense, everything, but I am independent. I am not under the modes of material nature, for they, on the contrary, are within me. This divine energy of mine, consisting of the three modes of material nature, or gunas, is difficult to overcome, but those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. Those miscreants who are grossly foolish, who are lowest among mankind, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender unto me. O best among Bharatas, four kinds of pious men begin to render devotional service unto me, the distressed, the desirer of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who is searching for knowledge of the Absolute. Of these, the one who is in full knowledge and who is always engaged in pure devotional service is the best, for I am very dear to him and he is dear to me. All these devotees are undoubtedly magnanimous souls, but he who is situated in knowledge of me I consider to be just like my own self. Being engaged in my transcendental service, he is sure to attain me the highest and most perfect goal. So we see in the Mahabharata, in the Bhagavad Gita, that absolute knowledge of Christ is acquired through service, through yajna. And that is the renunciation of false self nature, which is ego. Do you have any questions? No? Okay. Today is the 11th of 12 lectures. So next week, the lecture on Pisces will close this course, and I look forward to seeing you all there.
Gnostic Radio is made possible through the financial support of listeners like you. To make a tax-deductible donation, visit our website at GnosticTeachings.org. For questions about this or other lectures, we invite you to participate in the free discussion forum at GnosticTeachings.org. Thank you for your support. May all beings be happy.